This episode is brought to you in part by the American Homebrewers Association, who invites you to attend HomebrewCon this June 27th through June 29th in Providence, Rhode Island. HomebrewCon brings 3,000 homebrewers together for 3 days of brewing seminars, nighttime events, and camaraderie. HomebrewCon is also the leading showcase of brewing supplies and equipment. Visit homebrewcon.org to learn more. That's homebrewcon.org. To learn more. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 31st, 2019. That's a full month gone already. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, we head up to Rogers, Arkansas to talk to Bradley Riggs of Hawk Moth Brewing. Bradley is brewing commercially on a small scale, concentrating on old world wood-aged beers. I'll ask him how he got a bourbon barrel stout to weigh in at 16% ABV and still be drinkable and delicious. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint and our brewing rainbow shirt. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you'd do us the favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, they say that'll help new listeners to find us. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. We're running behind on posting video episodes in 2019 already, but Steve and I are set to get together this week to shoot a video episode on my latest 100% rye session pale ale. I went a bit in an English-inspired direction this time. It didn't go sour, and I didn't go, you know, West Coast hoppy. It weighs in at a tiny bit over 2% ABV, and I used Chinook in the 2-gallon batch. Which doesn't sound English. However, I think the finished product is nice and crisp without having, you know, big, huge, fruity hoppiness to it. And the mouthfeel is very substantial. I think I struck the balance just this side of slimy. And, you know, it's definitely not watery, even though it's 2% alcohol. So you'll have to watch out for that. Only 2 pounds of malted rye in this 2-gallon batch, and that's it. That's all the grain bill. I took some up to Casey Letellier at Ivory Bill Brewing yesterday in Siloam Springs, Arkansas, because we'd been talking about this style, and he liked it. So always nice to get some positive feedback from somebody who knows something about beer. And Casey has a new dry-hopped beer on tap that I would call a cream ale. They call it premium, I believe. It's brewed with local corn and Oklahoma malt, and it is delicious. So if you're in the neighborhood there, be sure to check that out. I finally got all the goodie bags out for the Disaster Show participants this week. It's nice to have that job done. Only about a month late, right? I've been doing pretty good about not procrastinating about things lately, but not starting out 2019 good in that way. I'm only missing 2 addresses, JD in Waukesha, Wisconsin, and Peter in Toronto. I've emailed you guys, JD and Peter, multiple times, and I think I'm in your spam folder. So JD and Peter, email me, and I'll get you your little goodie bags out. By the way, in case you're wondering, I am very prompt when shipping orders out from basicbrewingshop.com, so you don't have to wait there. Unless I need to have a shirt printed and that size is back orders or something like that with the shirt shop. So anyway, feel free to order worry-free at basicbrewingshop.com as far as promptness of orders go. Wow, it is cold in a lot of the U.S. this week. I got a tweet from Paul up in Minneapolis where it's 29 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit. That's around 34 degrees below 0 Celsius. Paul says, brewing today, I'm thinking about using the no-chill method. Whew, I think there's going to be some chilling. It's just not going to need any help. Man, I think fire freezes at that temperature. Speaking of no chill, I got an email recently from Ben in Durham, Maine. Ben says, I recently made a change to my brewing process and switched to no-chill brewing, a method, as from my understanding, popularized by Australian homebrewers. That's right. Started down there. I brew my normal brew-in-a-bag batch, says Ben, and at the end of the boil, simply run the hot wort out of the kettle and into a heat-safe plastic cube, in quotation marks. This is stored in my basement until the wort reaches the desired yeast pitching temp. I've made a few beers with this method so far, and they've all turned out pretty well. My most recent was a Vienna lager, and my question is about this beer. While I don't normally care about the clarity of my beer, this beer is very hazy and just doesn't present well. I've tried fining it with gelatin in the keg and cold conditioning for a few weeks, and the beer is still pouring cloudy. Is there anything that can be done to clear this beer, or am I going to have to make do with this tasty yet cloudy lager as a result of my no-chill method? Well, I've only brewed with no-chill once, so before we blame that method, I punted the question up to our good friend Bob Stimsky in Wisconsin, where it's darn cold up there, too. Bob says, I've been exclusively no-chill for a decade now. Wow. I really haven't had problems with clarity. Yes, an odd beer or two come up a bit cloudy, but cleared halfway through the keg. I don't think that no-chill has anything to do with the clarity problem. Bob says, here's what I do for all my beers. I use firm cap in my boil to prevent boilovers. I use it, too, during fermentation for about the same reason. I use Irish moss or a substitute in the last 15 minutes of the boil. I also add yeast nutrients in the last 15. My no-chill cube is left to room temperature, and I give the cube all day or overnight to settle out. I siphon carefully, leaving most of the tube behind. Tube in the fermentation vessel is okay, Bob says. It adds nutrients that aid in good fermentation. I use a canister of oxygen to aerate the wort and add more nutrients to boot. Wow. Bob feeds his yeast well. When done, in about 2 weeks, I transfer the finished beer to the keg to settle out. Bob says, in Wisconsin, I have the ability to cold crash my kegs prior to carbonating. In winter, I leave my keg in the garage, or in summer, I place it in the beer fridge. I use a snake or cobra head to carefully pull the first beer, thereby filling my first glass with any settled sediment. At this point, I could add gelatin if needed, Bob says. I carbonate by turning up the pressure and connecting the CO2 connector to the out connector of the keg the wrong way. I rock the keg side to side, and the pickup tube spills out the CO2 at the keg bottom, and as it rises through the beer upwards to the top, carbonating along the way. Well, there you go. And Bob says, finally, in a couple of weeks, I drink it. And Bob concludes, Ben, you may have to live with this Vienna lager being a bit hazy. It seems you did what I would have done. There are two solutions that I might do. Rename your beer to a New England IPA, which is naturally hazy, or add green food coloring and push your beer on St. Patrick's Day. Thanks, Bob. A few days later, we got another letter from Ben saying, thank you very much for responding to my question. It sounds like our brew days are very similar. I guess I just needed to wait a bit longer because I poured a glass of my Vienna lager yesterday evening and it had dropped clear. I will definitely be continuing to experiment with no-chill brewing. Well, there you go. I guess you can add patience to Bob's list of suggestions, although I don't know if beers last very long at Bob's house. You got to keep warm up there. You know, even in the summer. A good way to keep warm is with a tasty beer. And our sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa, have a suggestion for you, a new ingredient kit. Bubo McOwl's Wee Heavy. It's a beer with complex malty flavors of caramel, they say, that is suggestive of a fine dessert. Mmm! They say, think of it as a sticky toffee pudding in liquid form. Named in honor of Donovan, the owl on the label, Donovan owns the human known as Chris McKechnie, High Gravity's dear friend, employee, and the person who designed the kit. It comes in either extract or all grain and features naked oats, Crystal 80, flaked barley, and roasted barley with Kent Golding hops. And you get your choice of yeast to go along with it. It weighs in at around 6.5% to 7% ABV, so it's not huge, but it does sound delicious and satisfying without impinging too much on the New Year's resolutions. And while you're on highgravitybrew.com, of course, check out the variety of different styles of kits that they have. I've brewed High Gravity kits, and they're super easy and well done. They're well put together. And if you're tired of your propane tank freezing up in this frigid weather up north, check out all the electric brewing systems on highgravitybrew.com. 1, 2, and 3 vessel systems from 5 gallons all the way up to 2 barrels. You know I love my brew-in-a-bag electric system with the Warthog controller. It takes the pain out of propane, especially when the cold wind blows. And if you use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your electric brewing gear purchase. That's at highgravitybrew.com. Okay, let's head on up to Rogers, Arkansas to talk to Bradley Riggs of Hawk Moth Brewing, where in the background they are bottling up or labeling bottles of a new special release. Bradley Riggs, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Where are we at?
Well, we are actually at my place, Hawk Moth Brewing and Beer Parlor in Rogers, Arkansas.
Yet another brewery in Benton County. It's crazy. Not too long ago, as I say often on the show, Benton County was a dry county. And, you know, now it's becoming a beer center.
Yeah, it's. I would almost say it's kind of turned into what the mecca for the state is, Benton County, Arkansas. I think there's just in our county 8 or 9 breweries and kind of all feeding off of each other and doing different things, some big things. And, yeah, it's crazy how it happened in, what, like a 4-year window? I mean, that's about the total time. So.
Yeah. And we're running a daycare center as well, if you hear kids in the background. Do you see yourself as a family friendly? You're not open yet today, but do you see yourself as a family friendly place?
Yeah, we definitely are. We're kind of trying to create what we call brewery culture as opposed to bar culture, and that's something like, sure, when the sun goes down on Friday night, it's probably not the best place for a kid to be. But Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, you know, we've got craft sodas, we've got stuff like that. We want people to come out. I have kids, and so I know people that have kids, and this is just a good space for all of that to kind of mix into one family-friendly setting. Yeah.
So what's your origin story?
So I was born and raised in Rogers. I've lived in Benton County my entire life. But a lot of traveling and used to tour in a band and did that for a decade. And so kind of saw the world of beer outside of Arkansas. And it's really what made me fall in love with the culture and the industry itself. And, you know, East Coast, West Coast, they're kind of setting the trends. And about 5 years ago or so, I realized that I wanted to do something like that here, kind of in my hometown area, and started working in the beer industry, started managing a bar, and then from there moved to a distributor and ran a craft distributor with a few people and selling beer, and then I went to go work for an independent brand, New Province Brewing, also out of Rogers, and then from there came here to do my own thing. So I worked in all three tiers before I did it on my own, so I kind of knew what the industry looks like, how it was trending, all of that, where we needed to improve to catch up to the East and the West Coast, and yeah.
So are you one of the rare craft brewers who skipped home brewing?
No, not at all. I've been home brewing all along the way, and again, it was the same thing what we touched on at the beginning. Benton County was dry, so I'd go on these tours, try all this awesome beer. You know, we'd go to Three Floyds, or we'd go out to the brewery in California, or whatever it was, and we'd come home, and there actually weren't even breweries to come to where I was living. And so started brewing on my own, figuring out, well, what do I like? I'll just make it for myself in my garage or my kitchen or whatever. And that became an obsession along the way, and kind of dominoed with the industry steps, I guess.
And as a home brewer, as you were tinkering with your own beers, what did you gravitate towards?
Okay, so I feel like I'm not in the norm for saying this. The first beer I ever decided to take on and brew was a Beer to Guard. It wasn't a pale ale. It wasn't that. That was just where my mindset instantly was at. And it was okay. It wasn't good nor bad, I would say. But it was... I was so interested in, like, the French yeast strains and all of that character of the world. Not so much the traditional German or Belgian stories that you always hear. It was more of, like, these really dry super strains that you could take and do American twist with, where, like, we have all these hop varieties now and all these things that we can play with all the history of the old world. And that was instantly what I wanted to do, you know, when I started homebrewing 6 years ago or whatever. So
you started out of the box.
Out of the box, yes, absolutely. I mean, went all in. It was all grain. It was a Beer to Guard. It was totally trial and error. And then to kind of come full circle, the first beer I ever brewed on this system here, whenever we were opening, was a Beer to Guard. I was kind of tied to that, so I wanted to go ahead and do that. And this one obviously turned out a lot better than that one did many years ago. But I thought it was appropriate to kind of come full circle in my own world of doing it in my kitchen and then doing it on my system at my brewery all these years later. It was very cool.
Sure. Well, we've got a flight of four beers here in front of us. There are many more on the tap, but it's 10 o'clock in the morning. So
that's right. We'll get to them.
So what should I start with?
Well, let's see. I actually poured you kind of an obscure flight. It was four beers that were not pouring today in the tap room as we lead up to a big stout release weekend. We're pulling a lot of special kegs out and stuff like that for it. So I've got a cream ale for you that we'll tap, in theory, for the first time tomorrow. It was a traditional pre-prohibition six-row cream ale. And I use six row for everything in my brewery. I don't use two row, which is definitely not normal either. Wow. And I was looking at, oh, what do I want to do for this really light crusher style? And I thought a cream ale was appropriate because of the base grain. And then, as most of my beers, I take a style, I stick to it, and then I do like kind of my own modern twist on it. With that one, I used the new German Ariana hops. So you get a lot of this cool, like, subtle pear, maybe some stone fruit out of it. It's about as fruity of a cream ale as I've come across. It just, I don't know, it's really light, 5.6%, but it's just not what you would normally expect from that style, I think.
It's delicious. Thank you. It is, I like to brew a cream ale myself, and it's the noble hops, I think, that bring a lot to it, and just the nice standard, kind of, I don't want to say non-distracting, but the malt bill is just nice and solid, yeah. and kind of bready, and super easily drinkable. Now, I use corn or maize as an adjunct in mine. Do you use adjuncts in yours?
I used a lot in it. I probably used almost 20% corn in it. Which is why it almost has a bit of a hazy color to it. It was not intended to be a clear beer, and so using that much adjuncts certainly did it. Other than that, it was just six row and pilsner, and it's just intended to be as clean as possible.
So does a six row helps, you know, they say that it has higher enzymatic power. I guess if you're using adjuncts like corn or maize, six row would help in that.
Yeah, and with anything. So I'm a big stout brewer as well, and so I think, let you guys in on a little secret, I think six row is the secret to full flavored stouts. You can use a little more chocolate malt than you normally would, you know, maybe use some special B, all these things that add up to maybe 30% of your grain bill. But if you're using six row for the other 70, you never have a problem with it converting and really good fermentation and all of that with it. So
if I were to make a recipe with two row and another recipe with six row, what differences would I see between the two?
It's tough to say, I mean, without doing like a little bit of a brewlosophy experiment. You know, he's always doing the side-by-side brewing, and I really appreciate that. I don't know. I think for me, we've noticed we get a little more of those chocolate roasty flavors. but they're not nearly as harsh. They're not, there's no astringency in them. They're really, really smooth, even though you're using a little bit of a bigger percentage overall. So,
and do you see a difference in attenuation?
I get really good attenuation for whatever reason. So like with the French strains, I'm probably getting in the high 90s. I mean, it's drying almost all the way out. With the stouts, I'm going, most of the time I'm using classic Nottingham, rehydrating, and I'm probably still hitting in the low 80s, even when it's getting over double digits. So yeah, I would say that it has not been an issue, and that may be because of the sixth row overall.
Are there any challenges, especially at your scale, in using six row as opposed to two row?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any downside to it at all. I haven't found one yet. What, maybe it costs another cent or two a pound, but overall it's definitely worth it for what you're getting.
Now, what is your niche that you're carving out? You know, there, as we said before, there are more and more breweries coming in the area, and it's going to be harder and harder to distinguish yourself, you know, and to stand out and attract, you know, those craft beer drinkers to your establishment. What is your niche that's going to bring them in?
Yeah, and I mean, whenever you first walked in, we're kind of talking off the record about what am I brewing, and you know, fingers crossed, my philosophy is to never brew a pale ale. It's probably the most common beer in the craft industry overall, that or IPA, and we don't want to brew a pale ale. So there's a really great brewery 5 blocks away called Ozark Beer Company. They brew a really great pale ale, and we didn't want to just open our doors and do the same thing that they're doing. That's there's no room for that in our really young, growing craft beer market of Northwest Arkansas. Our focus is old world styles, a Grisette, a Beer de Garde, a Saison, you know, stuff, again, that you're playing with the yeast strain more than anything else to try and get some character out of it. And then a lot of barrel focus. As soon as you walk in, you see the wall of barrels. That was part of our plan from day one, was to try and do, you know, 20, 30, 40% of our total production out of wood in some capacity. And so we're 4 months in, and we were just able to add a 9-barrel vertical fooder from Fooder Crafters, and all of that is really part of our focus. And I think the average beer drinker or the expert beer drinker, whatever it is, they could walk into the building and just visually know that something different is happening because of all those things. And then they look at the board and they're like, oh, these are not styles that I see maybe anywhere, let alone in this area. So we're small batch through and through. We're only looking to do about 400 barrels a year, and you know, keep at least half of that in house with a little bit of distro here and there. But overall, yeah, we're not looking to play the tap handle game with other breweries. I did sales before this, and you just cannibalize each other. There's no real growth. It's not like when a new brand comes into the state, a bar is going to add another handle to their wall. They're not going to install more taps because there's more options. They're just going to choose a better one for their least selling one and cannibalize it. And so you have to do something different to stand out through style, through aesthetics, through branding, all of that. And yeah, I think that's what we're doing. We've been able to do it so far, and I think this entire year is going to establish that.
Well, that's interesting that you know, coming from the distribution side of things, you know, you kind of know the trappings of what's out there, and you know the kind of beer wars that are going on out there, and how you know, even the larger breweries are creating smaller brands and picking up smaller brands, and yeah, there is fierce competition for wall space and for cooler space, and it sounds like your strategy is to kind of keep out of that and create your own game.
Yeah, for sure. And I get it that, you know, the world of brewing, the world of beer, that whole industry, it is a business. I mean, we're all in this to try and create a life that we want and all of that. You know, the beer industry is a great quality of life. But we also want the mentality of playing nice with other breweries. You know, we have a rotating guest tap in our own tap room, and currently it's Bell's, which isn't even a local brewery. It's just, we really like what they are doing all the way up in Michigan, and so let's carry a product and expose the market to a cool style that maybe they're not drinking, because the market's definitely trending hyper-local, and that's okay for us. We benefit from the hyper-local, but we also want people to drink quality. Drinking local is great, but drinking quality is better, and we want to try and accomplish both of those for people, and we can do that without stepping on someone else's toes in the process, especially at 400 barrels a year. I mean, you know, you keep your overhead low and you dial in exactly what you're doing, and you can make money at that volume also. So,
If you don't make money, you don't get to make beer.
It turns out that's it is a business, but we're just trying to do it, I feel like, a little bit differently from other ones. Like, we're not going to be a production brewery. That's just not what we are. We're small batch through and through, and we get to have a little more fun maybe than they do as far as the styles of beer that we're brewing and all that. And so far, the market has appreciated that and supported it, while they're also still going out to restaurants and ordering Ozark Pale Ale or New Province IPA or whatever. Like, that's good for everyone. That's good for the restaurant. That's good for the other breweries and for the beer drinker, most importantly. Like, they're getting to experience different styles of beer and seeing that, hey, there's plenty of room for three breweries in a downtown Rogers setting. So you just got to be doing something different.
Speaking of drinking beers, where should I go next?
Man, let's see. So you came in with the expectations of drinking the IPA. Let's go to the IPA next. So, yeah, it's going to be the far left. So our IPA, again, we're doing all these old world styles, but we wanted to have something hoppy on the wall. I like drinking IPAs. And so we have what's called the Hoppy Tap. It's just a rotating hoppy beer. It's kind of a play on, you know, someone's like, why are you calling it that? And I'm like, well, you ever walk into a bar or hear someone walk into a bar and they're like, what do you have on tap that's hoppy? I mean, you hear that all the time. So if someone walks into the bar and says that, we're like, oh, well, we have a tap called the Hoppy Tap. I hope that covers what do you have on tap that's hoppy. And so it's a pretty similar grain bill most of the time. It's kind of we describe it as a West Coast grain bill almost meets an East Coast hop schedule, to where you're going to have that middle of the road 7% clean fermentation, but a lot of the, you know, a lot of the exploding juicy hops on the back end, Whirlpool dry hop, heavily dry hop stuff. And so batch 5 is Centennial and Citra. So far they've all had Citra in them, but the complementary hop has rotated every single time. So batch 4 was Hallertau Blanc, and now batch 5 is Centennial. So you get something like that candied orange that you're used to with that hop, but there's still a ton of citrus juiciness from the Citra hops.
So your sort of flagship IPA, quote unquote, is, it changes.
Yes, it changes about every 3 weekends. And again, that's small batch brewing. It keeps the regular interested to come in multiple times a month, because they might be an IPA guy, and we feel like we haven't let the market down yet. We haven't put out an IPA that we weren't really happy with. So while they've all 5 have been different, they've all 5 been good in their own way. And it's fun to talk with people like, oh, what's your favorite one? And, you know, and the whole theory is like, everyone's always like, oh, batch 1's my favorite, because they can't actually remember what batch 1 tasted like, you know. So it's always easier with anything, with any beer, to be like, oh, I think batch 1's my favorite. But people talk about, you know, batch 4 or batch 3, and it's fun to take their notes and apply them. And then batch 6, we kind of use a little bit of all that and make another one. So,
And it's tricky, because you can taste the same beer. You know, you can get a 12-pack of beer that came off the same production run. Mm-hmm. And depending on the time of day, depending on what you've eaten that day, and those beers can taste different from can to can. So it's kind of tricky for people to come in and say, oh, I remember that one. I like that one.
Exactly. Like, who knows where they were at? Did they come from another bar before that drinking whiskey or whatever it is and then come in? I mean, all that's going to play into the factor. But it's fun, and it's always going to be fresh. So the IPA being our quickest selling beer, we're brewing it every 3 weeks, and so the hops are never going old. They're always as bright as they can be, and that's also part of the fun with that.
It's very nice. It's very fresh. It's got a nice malt backbone. The bitterness is nice and crisp. I get a lot of floral notes. Then maybe it's the time of day again, but floral and perfumey. Not necessarily like the, you know, West Coast mango-y, you know, grapefruity, tropical fruit kind of thing. This is just super nice and floral and perfumey and very drinkable.
Awesome. Yeah, that's definitely part of the goal. You know, with only having one IPA, we needed it to be a catch-all. It's not a single. It's not really a double. It's 7.2%. That's usually where it's at. And kind of falls in between. So hopefully, yeah, if you're into the East Coast, the West Coast, whatever your preference is, it's not too bitter. We always make sure that it's still a bit of a gateway IPA, or like a, you know, a more of that new wave IPA. But I think it can appeal to just a lot of hoppy beer drinkers with some of those characters you mentioned.
So you're talking to home brewers mostly. There are some professional brewers out there, but what is your dry hopping strategy to get such nice fresh hoppy notes from a beer?
Yeah, the big thing is, if I'm looking at what bitterness do you want to hit, what's your perceived bitterness going to be? Is it going to be around 70 IBUs or whatever it is? If that's the case, let's try and get about a third of that from early bitterness. So let's use something high alpha acids, typically Magnum for us, and we'll do a 30-minute addition of Magnum to get about a third of our total bitterness. Then we're trying to achieve two-thirds of it in the whirlpool. So you're using a lot. You're using probably 2 pounds per barrel in the whirlpool. And then same thing on the dry hop. You're using about 2 pounds per barrel on the dry hop. I usually do two different dry hops with two different varieties of hops. You can use the same one two different times, but I don't know how much you would notice it if it wasn't two different varieties. So with batch 5, I think we did Centennial on just after peak fermentation. Like, it wasn't as early as day 4 or something, but it was probably just a day or two after, and then Citra probably a day or two after that. And so Citra was pretty fresh. It was only in there for probably 24 hours before we went ahead and did a partial crash on it, but because of that, it's as fresh as it can be, and we closed the tank off at that point too. And if it builds some pressure in the tank with all the hops in there, even better. It's just going to keep the aroma in before you keg it.
So. And it's nice and clear too. So, do you filter?
We don't filter anything. We joke about that one a lot. That one actually had more adjuncts in it than the previous 4 batches. We probably used, 25% between, flaked wheat, flaked oat, stuff like that, and it cleared up more than all the other ones. Sometimes that's just part of it. I mean, it seriously almost looks like High Life or something. You can read a book through it. And why it did that on batch 5, I don't exactly know. That's part of the fun of everyone changes too, so I'm probably never going to brew that same one again to figure out exactly why it did it. Did the yeast flock out too much, or was the temperature too low? I mean, who knows, but was the water too hard? Like, all of that, but batch 6 will be something different.
And what yeast was it?
That one was an Omega West Coast 4. Yeah.
So. Well, it's delicious. So what? We got two left in the sample here.
Yeah, we've saved two of the stranger ones for you. I think you'll have a lot of fun with them. The oranger one on the right. That's a I'm trying to think. I think it's close to like a 7%. Beardegard, and you're smelling it, you can't figure out what's going on right now on the nose.
Super fruity.
We gin barrel fermented that, and then after the barrel, it was a small barrel, so it was like a 25-gallon Rocktown gin barrel. After about 100 days, which is long for that period of time, pulled it out and steeped it with...
Can I say an adjective before you... Yeah. I smell apricots.
Okay. Very good. So, you're going down the right track here. We ended up steeping a Rubus tea blend into the beer before we kegged it, after the barrel. Huh. Yeah. So, there in the tea blend, there was some apricot, there was some mango, there was a ton of orange peel in it, wow. And it's probably like something you haven't come across before, right? It's so strange, it almost makes you wonder if it's a beer, and... That was only a one-barrel batch, so we can do whatever we want with a one-barrel batch. And that one was very well-received. We did a glassware party with it, kind of a Negroni-themed night from the gin barrel. And that was back in December, but we've got one keg that we held on to for this weekend. And because of the next beer is why we held on to it. So, yeah.
Wow. It's potpourri-like without being offensive. It's not grandma's bathroom.
I want you to make a candle that smells like this, and I mean that in the best way possible. Because sometimes you smell things that, yeah, are almost offensive in the way that they're so floral. But this is just, I don't know, it was a unique beer. Probably won't ever do it again, but it was a lot of fun, and we got one more keg of it.
Yeah, it's very tasty. It's very drinkable. Like I say, that I still, even in the flavor, I'm getting like apricot, mm-hmm. And it's sort of like some of the flavors I get from some hops, you know, doing hop stands and things like that. You know, there's that mango or there's that tropical fruit flavor that comes with those as well. So I think it fits. I think it does taste like a beer. It just tastes like one that's, you know, that's had some, you know, extremely late hops or hop stand hops or, but then there's also some spice in there, and probably comes from the tea as well. So very nice, very drinkable. So what are your goals with all this wood? You know, you got the first fooder and the second fooder, I guess, in Arkansas. One in Northwest Arkansas.
Got one, and I mean, goal with that specifically is a lot of times people just almost expect some sort of mixed culture to come out of the fooder. With this specific one, for the first one, we're actually looking to do a bit of a take on think like Dogfish, like Oak Age Bitches Brew or Palo Santo Brown Ale, where it's essentially a year-round wood-aged beer. And we want to do a Solera Stout out of it where, you know, every 4 months or so we're pulling it and packaging it, whether it's through bottles or kegs, and then topping it off so it, 'cause it's twice the size of our tank, so we'd have to double batch into it. So we're always going to be pulling half of it out, do a Solera where you're just constantly topping fresh liquid onto the mature liquid and then pulling it every couple months or whatever, and it creates a year-round oak-aged Russian. And I think that's going to be a lot of fun. I don't know if I've actually had something quite like that before, but that's also part of the excitement, I think, with using those for whatever you can imagine.
And are you talking about using the same recipe every time or evolving it as it goes along? Or I guess it's that you can decide that when you come to it.
Again, it's all trial and error. So for the first two batches to top it off, they were pretty close to the same thing. Overall, it's going to be blended to about a 10% Russian Imperial. But, yeah, that might change along the way. Maybe we drop the alcohol. Maybe we add some different adjuncts into it to create different flavors. But we also want to be able to pull, you know, a barrel from it on occasion and blend it with a different barrel if we think that it could use some more body or whatever. It's really going to allow us to stretch the imagination as to what we can do with it. And that's the fun stuff.
And a lot of times when people see barrels, they may think of bugs, you know, of different organisms other than Saccharomyces going in there. Yeah. Are you going to be, you know, this is a fairly small space that you've got here. Are you going to be messing with, you know, funky beers?
Man, the longer we go, the crazier we'll get. We know that. You know, the business plan was like, oh, we've got to keep Brett out of the building. It's just, it's too scary to work with in a small setting. It makes all your clean beers taste like whatever it wants to. But I don't know. Our mindset is stay ahead of boredom. So I really don't know what to tell you. I mean, we're already 4 months in, and who knows where it's trending. So,
well, we'll stay tuned for that. Yeah. We've got one more beer. What do we got here?
Okay, so that's the big one of this weekend. So you're here the last weekend in January, and it's our. Bourbon Barrel-Aged Russian Imperial Stout. It's something that I am as proud of as any beer I've ever made in my life. It checks in at 16.1%, and we believe that's the biggest beer commercially ever made in Arkansas. We kind of wanted to set down a path of, how big can we make a stout while it also tastes extremely drinkable? It probably drinks like a 10 or a 12% stout, and you know, it's got some bourbon character, but it didn't translate too hot, and I don't know. I was really proud with that beer. So that's going to be the bottle release tomorrow, and that's why we're pulling out the gin barrel beer to guard keg for it to have it on the wall as well. And this should be a lot of fun. We're hoping a lot of people turn out for it from the region.
Well, it's super nice. It's delicious, and it's, you know, you gave me the big old Bell's beer to start me out to warm me up. And it stands up to it as far as the quality of brew. It's you know, it's, you say it's 16%. I'll take your word for it. Sure. But it doesn't taste like you know, a big old high alcohol beer. It's not hot as in high alcohol at all. In fact, you know, maybe my tolerance for those, you know, flavors has changed over time. But it's not like drinking a big old beer. And there is a bourbon character to it. There is, you know, kind of some sweeter notes as well, some sort of molasses-y notes and some coffee notes as well.
We get some dark fruit out of it for whatever reason. I used a little bit of Special B, and so that kind of has like that strong raisin, and I think it held up throughout the whole process. It was like a 1 or 2%, you know, dose of Special B, but I think it's there in the end. For the homebrewers out there, speaking of gravity and getting it there, so it started at 35 Play-Doh, which is the biggest I've ever started a beer. And it wasn't intended to get to 16. We were shooting for 14.5, but it got down to like 3.5 Play-Doh. So there was over 30 Play-Doh of fermentation, and it was cool. It was an experiment, and we're really happy with it. Maybe it's a little drier than we would have wanted from it fermenting out, but that also might be why it drinks so easy, because it's got a ton of body still, but it's not too heavy. Even if that makes sense, as a 16% stout, it's heavy, but it's not too much, and it's not syrupy at all. I'll say that.
No, it's super drinkable. I mean, it's, you know, it's not like a big motor oil beer, which you would expect out of a giant, you know, beer like this. It's very, very dark, but, you know, for safety's sake, you wouldn't want a pint of it.
No,
but you could definitely drink a pint of it.
Yeah, so we're selling 500 mil bottles of it, and then draft pours, we're doing 5-ounce draft pours of it. We're doing a party. So we actually got we used 2 Four Roses single barrels, and we got the barrels from 2 local places that did a barrel program, a bar in downtown Bentonville called Scotch and Soda. They gave us their barrel, and then a local liquor store called Doctor's Orders gave us their barrel, and we dove into them. Like, as soon as they were dumped, like, they were still really, really wet barrels. And yeah, so we're actually doing the pre-party for the stout at Scotch and Soda tonight, and yeah, they're doing 8-ounce pours there, because we're just like, oh man, we can't serve a lot of this beer. People are really going to get in trouble because it drinks too easy. So
yeah, okay. So how do you get to 16%? What yeast did you use, and what strategy did you use to keep the yeast happy? Because it is happy. You could tell, because there's no off, you know, stressed yeast off flavors in this beer at all.
So we used Nottingham again for that one. It's definitely a super strain. I mean, it can hold up to 14%, I think, pretty easily and pretty consistently. We also had a little bit of diastaticus in it to help. So it's kind of, you know, almost in that same world of Brett, where it can convert dextrins and things like that. So, and it also doesn't necessarily have an alcohol limit, almost like a champagne-type yeast, where probably about day 10 into fermentation, it had started to slow down, and there was probably still, I don't know, 7 points left. We pitched a little bit of table sugar in it, woke it back up, and then immediately transferred it to the barrels. And in doing all of that at once, it took off again and ate another almost 4 points. So, yeah.
And the table sugar probably helped out in drying out the beer as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think it gave it some more easy sugars as all the long chain stuff was left. And so it set it up, and then it just started dominoing into converting all of those as well.
But again, it's not, you know, you would be afraid, you know, that adding such a simple sugar would heat up the alcohols in the beer. But it doesn't at all. Whether all the other stuff that's in the beer hides it or not, it's not there.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. Like, I don't think you can make a, you know, not that it exists, but you can't make a 16% cream ale. You can't hide enough things in a 16% cream ale base. You can get away with a lot of things with stouts. Sometimes they're the hardest styles to make, but sometimes, in that regard, they're the easiest styles to make. You can, you know, I kept it mid-60s fermentation for all the primary, and so it was definitely healthy in that process and active, but it never got too hot, I would say. And then by the time most of the primary was done, putting it in the barrel, I don't know, I mean, it probably saw mid-70s, I would think, in the barrel, but not for an extended period of time. And we've got barrels in our lobby, and our lobby probably sits around 60 degrees, actually. So that was probably, that probably aided in keeping it clean.
So other than, what is it about the physics of the barrels that you like?
they can offer flavor additions that you can't just get from grains or hops. They're bringing an X factor to a beer, and it doesn't like beer like good beers don't have to be barrel aged. You can get whatever flavors you want, but in this case, I was looking for some flavors that I knew were going to have to come from something secondary. I was looking for that oak flavor, for some of that vanilla bourbon character, and yeah, you can't get that without those things, without a oak bourbon barrel. So that was the reasoning for this one. You know, some of the best stouts I've ever had were actually not barrel aged, and I think that's more impressive when you can deliver those flavors without the X factor, then you've really done something well. But with this one, we knew we wanted to get the X factor flavors. So,
well, very nice. What's one question? What's the next thing? What are we to look for it from Hawk Moth Brewing?
Yeah. So 2019, we did a lot of, like, again, we sourced a lot of barrels even before our grand opening, and we wanted to get them filled immediately and get set up for this year. So we opened back in September. We started brewing back in July, I think it was, and immediately started filling barrels. So 2019 is going to allow us to do a bottle release from a barrel every single month of the year. And that's really cool, man. Like, I was a beer drinker before I was a beer brewer, and that's something that I would want to go to and be a part of in my local community. It's like, oh man, last Saturday of the month or whatever it's going to be, I'm going to go over to Hawk Moth and pick up bottles of whatever this small batch 300 bottle release is or whatever. So the stout's a 500 bottle release. They're all going to be tiny releases, but that's going to be fun, that it's going to be so consistently happen.
Very nice. Very impressive. You sneaked into the, you know, through social media and things like that, you know, I saw you pop up and I was like, you know, who are these guys now? And I had no idea who you were. And then I started seeing, you know, pictures and things of, you know, beers that you were brewing. And it's like, wow, these guys are they're hitting the ground running. You know, these are aggressive, ambitious beers to be brewing right out of the gate. But I have to say, you know, what I've had here with this flight is very impressive.
Awesome, man. I really appreciate it. We kind of know that we're the new kids on the block. And again, there's so many breweries now, you've got to do something to stand out. And so there was no other way to do it than hit the ground running. So I think we're doing our best at that.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks again to Bradley. Delicious beers and neat setup. I like Bradley's approach, carving out a niche without having designs to take over the world. And another reason to come down or up to Northwest Arkansas to check out the brewing scene. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. And be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site and get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can find our logbooks where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all that out at basicbrewingshop.com. Also, take a look at our silicone pints. So until next time, until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.